Thank you, Don DeBar, and Research Fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Samueli there from Budapest. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitahvayis, goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Look at our headlines. Syria's President Assad visits the United Arab Emirates in his first trip to an Arab state since the war started over a decade ago. Ukraine's President Zelensky says it's time for comprehensive security talks with Moscow as Russia's lead negotiator reports some progress in ceasefire talks. Also ahead, Britain bans Russian broadcaster RT over the Ukraine conflict. Coming up, Press TV's report from London. Thanks for joining us. The United Arab Emirates says Syria is a fundamental pillar of Arab security as Syrian President Bashar al-Assad visits the Persian Gulf country. Abu Dhabi's Crown Prince says the Emirate is keen to strengthen cooperation with Damascus. Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan made the comments in a meeting with Assad. The Syrian president also held talks with Dubai's ruler, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. They emphasized the need for protection of the territorial integrity of Syria and the withdrawal of foreign forces from the country. This was Assad's first visit to an Arab country since the beginning of war in Syria in 2011. Back in 2018, the UAE also reopened its embassy in Damascus and called for Syria's return to the Arab League. Earlier, our correspondent in Syria, Mohammed Ali, gave us the details on the Syrian president's visit to the Emirates.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad visited the United Arab Emirates. He was welcomed there, and he met with the Vice President, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. Then Syrian President Bashar al-Assad also met with the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, who also welcomed the Syrian President there in Abu Dhabi, and said that this visit comes in the framework of perhaps joint keenness on continuing continuing consultation and coordination between the two countries on various issues, regional issues and international issues. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad also said that the UAE plays a very important role, taking into consideration balanced policies that it adopts towards international issues. Also, President Bashar al-Assad pointed out that the world is changing heading in the direction of instability, and thus President Assad went on to say, in order to protect our region, we must continue to adhere to our principles, to the sovereignty of our countries and the interests of our people.
Also earlier, we were joined by human rights activist Firas al-Najim to get his thought on the Syrian president's visit to the UAE. He said, Abu Dhabi has come to accept that Assad has big support inside Syria and cannot be removed.
This just shows that Bashar Assad has been victorious, with this big battle that's happening against him. And so many countries are involved in this, including the UAE. And, they failed miserably in this battle against Bashar Assad. Now they have, submitted to the reality is that Bashar Assad has, a strong support base inside Syria, and that he was able to resist and fight all these, Takfiri groups, all these terrorist groups, and all this Western, engineering to get him out of power, because obviously he's supportive of the resistance in the area, and he's a key ally to the Islamic Republic of Iran. So the UAE cannot be trusted in any way. You know, they're a puppet regime. They're serving the U.S. interest. Now they're serving, obviously, now more the Israeli interest because they're getting deeper in this hole that they put themselves in. And I'm pretty sure that, he's a very wise man, Bashar Assad, so he's taking all that into consideration as well when he's dealing with them. And I'm pretty sure he's conveying to them the message of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the allies and their experience in this 11-year-old war.
Iran and the P4+1 group have almost concluded months of talks to revive the 2015 deal. As we will see in this next report, Iran says a deal is closer than ever, but it's reiterated that the ball is in the West's court.
The fate of many months of intense negotiations in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to revive the 2015 Iran deal hangs in the balance. The dialogue seems to face a make-or-break moment in the coming days. A draft text of an agreement between Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, is almost complete. The diplomatic effort seems to be near a climax, but still the very few remaining gaps in the text are keeping the whole thing in limbo. This week, Iran's top diplomat Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the parties are closer than ever to a final agreement.
The Iranian government has made it very clear that the red lines that have to be respected and not crossed include a respect for Iran's missile program, which is well within its sovereign rights. A lifting of the brutal economic sanctions that have been placed on the Iranian nation and the Iranian people, and likewise for the guarantee that the United States would not remove itself and break the deal once again.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian said that Tehran is ready for a final deal if its red lines are observed. He said a good and lasting deal can definitely emerge in Vienna if the United States acts realistically and refrains from making new and wrong demands. He made the remarks soon after a trip to Moscow, where he sat down with his counterpart Sergei Lavrov. The meeting came amid speculations that Russia's demands for written guarantees from the U.S. to ensure that Tehran-Moscow trade ties will not be affected by Western sanctions over Ukraine have complicated the Vienna talks. But the Iranian and Russian top diplomats made it clear that that is not the case.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Russia has created no obstacle to reaching a deal between Iran and the P4+1 group in Vienna. He noted that Russia will remain by the side of Iran until the end of the negotiations. The Russian Foreign Minister announced Moscow has received the written assurances that it demanded. Let's see this next report.
During a joint press conference with his Iranian counterpart in Moscow, Lavrov ended speculations about Russian demands regarding the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The Russian foreign minister made it clear that Moscow has received written guarantees from Washington that Western sanctions will not prevent cooperation within the framework of the Iran deal. He noted that no illegal sanctions can stop the growth of Iran-Russia ties. The top Russian diplomat stressed that Moscow wants a quick revival of the JCPOA, and the Americans must return to the agreement and lift their illegal sanctions. The ball now seems to be in America's court if it is serious about reviving the JCPOA. Negotiators in Vienna have been trying to find a way to remove American unilateral sanctions against Iran and allow the U.S. to return to the 2015 deal. The U.S. sanctions were imposed after U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018. U.S. President Joe Biden has acknowledged that his predecessor's pullout was wrong. But Biden's words have done little to solve America's credibility problem.
So one of the things that we have to be very concerned about is that the U.S. Unwillingness to agree that they will never leave the deal and resume coercive sanctions means that it is very likely that if another U.S. administration is elected, especially a Republican one that is more hawkish on foreign policy, and more closely aligned with Israel, that they will leave the deal and reimpose sanctions on Iran. And one must be made very well aware of the fact that the Zionist lobby in the United States is extremely powerful.
Observers believe that the United States, as the party that abandoned the deal and threw the JCPOA in tatters, is expected to do more now that the negotiations have reached this critical stage. The coming days will probably show whether Washington will take the necessary political decisions.
Moving on, Ukraine's president calls for meaningful peace and security talks with Russia to end the ongoing conflict in his country.
We were always insisting on the negotiations. We were always offering dialogue, offering a solution for peace, not only during the 23 days of invasion. And I want everyone to hear me now, especially in Moscow. The time has come for a meeting. It is time to talk.
Zelensky says this is Russia's only chance to reduce the harm from its own mistakes. He warned Russia that pushing its campaign means it would need generations to recover from losses suffered during the war. Zelensky added that the time has come to restore the territorial integrity of Ukraine. He also accused Russian forces of blocking the supply of humanitarian aid to Ukrainian cities. Kiev and Moscow have held several rounds of talks on a ceasefire. Russia's lead negotiator earlier said the talks are making progress on Ukraine's demilitarization. He said, however, that Moscow's demand for, quote, denazification of Ukraine is yet to be met. Presidents of China and the United States discussed the war in Ukraine in a virtual meeting with the Chinese leader calling for dialogue to resolve the crisis. Xi Jinping said the U.S. and NATO should recognize the security concerns of Moscow and Kiev. Xi also criticized the Western sanctions on Russia. He said the measures could trigger serious crises across the globe. Xi added that the war needs to end as soon as possible. The U.S. president also backed a diplomatic solution in Ukraine. However, he warned China of consequences if it provides material support to Russia's military campaign. Earlier, China and Russia rejected the U.S. claim that they discussed supply of military equipment for Russian forces in the conflict. Political commentator Sarah Flounders believes the U.S. has sabotaged efforts to resolve tensions between Ukraine and Russia diplomatically.
I think the U.S. has been completely against any form of dialogue and has sabotaged every effort at a diplomatic solution. They have pumped billions and billions of dollars of lethal weapons, heavy weapons, nuclear-capable weapons into the Ukraine, right on the Russian border. They have been firing into eastern Ukraine, right on the Russian border, for 8 years. 14,000 people have died. in these the coming attacks coming from the Ukrainian government, all funded by the United States and by NATO. So rather than in any way pull back on this, instead you have discussions of a no-fly zone. I mean, that's a real nuclear threat. You have sending in heavier and heavier weapons through Poland, Hungary, so on, the surrounding countries, right again on Russia's border. So I think the United States has to, Biden administration has to show some willingness to have negotiations to stop the funding of these forces and the sending of U.S. troops.
British media regulator Ofcom has banned Russian news channel RT from broadcasting in the UK over Moscow's military offensive in Ukraine. Media observers have slammed the move as anti-democratic and an attack on freedom of speech and of the press. London correspondent Said Pourreza has our report.
It's now official. Russia's English-language state broadcaster RT stripped of its broadcasting license in the UK.
The decision was made by media regulator Ofcom that said it does not consider RT, with studios in the building behind me, fit and proper to hold a UK license, and that it cannot be satisfied that RT can be a responsible broadcaster.
To some, the move that followed weeks of rising tensions between Russia and the West over the Ukraine crisis was long overdue. To others, censorship, pure and simple. Journalist Afshin Ratansi is the host of the broadcaster's flagship program, Going Underground.
We've been in this situation together when they banned Press TV, Iran's program. I worked for Press TV. They banned that. They banned CGTN, the Chinese television company. Now they're banning RT. It just shows how much Britain is on the wrong side of history. It is the end of press freedom, the end completely, to me, it seems like, of informed consent, as in democracy. You can't have democracy without informed consent, and the British people can no longer watch programs that dissent from the prevailing narrative fed to us by the BBC and others.
The decision has also called into question Ofcom's independence. RT Deputy Editor-in-Chief Anna Belkina accused the regulator of being nothing more than a tool of the government.
I don't like censorship of any kind. I very much believe in freedom of speech. With freedom of speech comes responsibility, which is why we have Ofcom as a regulator. But if Ofcom is going to become an extension of the government peddling out that particular government style of propaganda, we are indeed entering into very dangerous territory.
As RT falls victim to unmitigated hostility towards Russia over Ukraine, media consumers here in the UK lose an important source that's brought them the other side of so many stories for so many years. Said Pourreza, London.
The UN World Food Programme is warning the European countries and the U.S. against ignoring global crises beyond Ukraine. The director of the agency says neglecting those crises could lead to catastrophic consequences. David Beasley says rising hunger could cause mass migration and fuel further instability in poorer countries. This comes after the UN warned that Russia's military campaign in Ukraine could aggravate hunger crises in countries such as Yemen and Ethiopia. Ukraine is one of the largest grain exporters in the world. And a U.S. military aircraft with four people aboard has crashed in northern Norway. The incident took place during a NATO military exercise. The fate of the passengers of the V-22 Osprey is still unknown. The Norwegian military says the plane was caught in bad weather and hit the ground. Search and rescue teams are looking for the missing passengers. Currently, 3,000 U.S. Marines are taking part in war games in northern Norway. The drills are staged amid rising tensions between Russia and NATO over Ukraine. Hundreds gathered in London on Friday to protest the strip search of children inside schools. Research shows black children are disproportionately targeted, and parents and community members say police shouldn't be in schools in the first place. Well, that's your world news for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger, to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately, to help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me, in full, in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
The IPC analysis expresses particular concern that 31,000 people in Yemen are currently facing extreme hunger levels, what it classifies as a Phase 5 catastrophe, and that the figure is projected to rise to 161,000 over the second half of the year. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Andrea Germanas, journalist. This article is published under the heading Famine in Yemen could increase fivefold without immediate action, UN warns. Here's the story. Multiple United Nations agencies have recently sounded heightened alarm over the food crisis in Yemen, warning of a projected fivefold increase in famine conditions. Warnings from the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Programme, WFP, and UNICEF came in response to the just-released Integrated Phase Classification IPC analysis on Yemen, which lays primary blame for the food crisis and the ongoing conflict. The IPC is a collaborative initiative that tracks the severity and magnitude of acute and chronic food insecurity in hotspots across the globe. The IPC analysis expresses particular concern that 31,000 people in Yemen are currently facing extreme hunger levels, what it classifies as a Phase 5 catastrophe, and that the figure is projected to rise to 161,000 over the second half of the year. The report also categorized 17.4 million people in Yemen in at least a Phase 3 serious acute malnutrition stage and in need of assistance. The number is expected to increase to a record 19 million starting in June. There are also 2.2 million children acutely malnourished, 538,000 of whom are severely malnourished. Further troubling is that 1.3 million pregnant and lactating women are also suffering from acute malnutrition. More and more children are going to bed hungry in Yemen, UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell said in a statement, adding, "This puts them at increased risk of physical and cognitive impairment and even death." She said, "The plight of children in Yemen can no longer be overlooked. Lives are at stake." In a statement earlier this month, WFP Executive Director David Beasley warned that the Saudi-led U.S.-backed invasion of Yemen will impact global supply chains and the cost of food. Beasley expressed concern that malnourished Yemeni children have been forgotten by the world. Reacting recently to the IPC report, Beasley said, "These harrowing figures confirm that we are on a countdown of catastrophe in Yemen and we are almost out of time to avoid it." He said, "Unless we receive substantial new funding immediately, mass starvation and famine will follow. But if we act now, there is still a chance to avert imminent disaster and save millions." The Iranian New Year, Nowruz, is almost here.
Join iRabi English Radio on Sunday afternoon, 20th of March at 1500 hours GMT as we chime in the new year at 1533 GMT.
We celebrate Nowruz live on air on Sunday afternoon, March 20th, 2022, around the traditional half-seen table.
We wish you a wonderful and prosperous Nowruz.
disasters that threaten the population of the Gaza Strip.
How's your work? What have you accomplished? Not much. We stopped the construction of the house because of the construction materials crisis in the Gaza Strip. There are no construction materials available, no cement, no steel, and no whitewash. Most construction materials stopped entering the Strip due to the Egyptian army's military operations in the Sinai. In addition, they have already destroyed most of the tunnels between Egypt and Gaza, through which all materials used to enter. Now they have disappeared from the local market. On the other hand, Israel has been blocking all crossings to the Gaza Strip for 7 years.
When we decided to expose the problem of unemployment in the Gaza Strip, we were confused about a starting point, but we met with an informative colleague, Mr. Atif Isa, who paved the way for us. He told us about his suffering over 7 years in building his dream house, which is still under construction at the moment. According to his plan, he was supposed to be done 5 years ago.
According to my house plan, the house is supposed to be ready now, and I would have moved into it. But as you can see, it seems to be ready from the outside, but work still needs to be done. These days, I am supposed to have at least 5 or 6 teams working at the same time. These teams provide job opportunities to about 30 or 40 workers. That means there are 30 to 40 families that used to have income, but not anymore because I have stopped the building of my house. I'm the head of a family of 6 people. All I want is a job opportunity, and everything will go fine with me. I wish other workers could work too, like the old days of working in a team. There were supposed to be more than 20 workers working on this scaffolding. However, there are only 2 or 3 people because of the shortage in construction materials. Their being here is inconsistent. As you can see, no improvements seem to occur.
These 2 workers are the only ones among over 30 who continued working here to make a living. Ibrahim, Raed's colleague and cousin, is the only one who remained to work with him, doing some modest jobs, despite knowing very well that he's not the right person in the right place.
I have learned the Holy Quran by heart and studied at private schools. Then I pursued my study in Malaysia at East Asia University. My major was the Prophet's Hadiths. After that, I came back to Gaza. As you can see, I work in construction. We have no chance to work in related fields. The crossings are blocked, and there aren't any projects or development. There is nothing. There are approximately 35,000 unemployed graduates. Because of the blockade, this number has risen in light of the rapid increase in the number of graduates from the Palestinian and Arab universities. This means that there is a large number of graduates per year. More than 10,000 graduates joined the previous number of the unemployed because of the lack of opportunities.
Hamza Hassan from the Beach refugee camp has joined the army of the unemployed after 4 years of study in the English Literature Department at the Faculty of Arts. 2 years after graduation, he lives a conflict between dreaming of a certificate and looking for any job, even if it's not related to his field of study.
I graduated from university after 4 years of studying English literature. I and most of the other young people were surprised with the fact that there are no work opportunities. Even if one does not want to work in one's field of study, it is hopeless. Youth also suffer from boredom. Young people spend some time out, just like myself. We spend most of our time in having food, sleeping, and hanging out.
The Gaza Strip is surrounded by seven crossings. The Rafah crossing is the only one connecting the Gaza Strip with an Arab country, Egypt. But the other six crossings are fully controlled by the Israeli occupation. And most of them are completely blocked most of the time. The only commercial crossing, left partially open, is the Kerem Shalom crossing. It is controlled by the Israeli soldiers Mood.
The needs of the Gaza Strip exceed 800 trucks a day. Meanwhile, the Israeli occupation prevents more than 480 to 500 trucks from entering Gaza. These goods are very important for the development of the Palestinian economy and include all raw materials, machinery, and equipment required for the development of the economy or solving the problems of production lines. I am Majid Abdul Hafiz Abu Salim. I own a sewing factory that produces bags. This bag factory has stopped working for a long time because of the siege and the occupation. This is a leather sewing machine that we use in producing leather bags. All these machines as well. As you see, they are all off. There were 12 to 15 workers. However, after the blockade, the factory has stopped. All the workers have lost their jobs and spend their time at home or in hanging out. I used to work as a tailor. I haven't worked for almost 9 years now because of the siege, the blockade, and the Israeli restrictions. I have six daughters, three sons, and there's my wife and I. I cannot fulfill their needs. We're currently living by help and aid. Our life is very difficult, and the unemployment rate has become great. When school started, I didn't buy new bags, clothes, or anything for my kids because I was not ready to buy them their school needs and let them suffer hunger later. Thank God I'm not renting my house. May Allah help those who rent. I am not renting, though I suffer very much. الله يساعد المتأجرين دور يعني أنا داري مش متأجرها ووضعي كئيب جدا جدا أنا سجين مبعد ساكن بيت إيجار. I am a deported prisoner and I am renting a house. Currently my family lives by relief supplies and aid. There isn't a job opportunity and the situation is really difficult. As you see, I have six kids. Come in please. This is one of my sick kids. Please come in. This is Mohammed. He is sick. What does he suffer from? He has convulsions, epilepsy, mental retardation, and speech difficulties. If he walks along the street, he wouldn't know where he is going. Every time he goes out by himself, I go bring him from a different place.
My sister-in-law has got rid of this closet, and I thought of removing my kids' clothes into it instead of being on the floor. All the kids' clothes are damaged. If my husband had a job with a monthly income of $200, not $400, it would be enough to pay for the owner of the house the first month, and the next month, we could buy a closet like most of the people. We could buy a bed for ourselves. We had a bed and a closet when we got married, but we sold them to afford the housing rent, because the house owners would kick us out. They're not tolerant and they would ask for their money. The house does not have appropriate doors or windows, but we had no choice.
I tried to get a job. I worked as a taxi driver, but it wasn't helping because of the fuel crisis. And if you want to do something else, it must be at the expense of your health. I used to work in construction, but construction has stopped in the strip. The crossings are all blocked and the situation is very bad. The construction materials are very expensive and rare. I am sick and can't do tiring work. In winter, water reaches up to this level. Even when I tried to make a hole in the wall to let the water out, some of the street water started flooding, and its level was higher than the kids' knees. We used to fill 6 or 7 buckets with water to get rid of it. People like winter, but I don't. I don't like it because it is tiring. This is our kitchen. The walls are cracked because of the rocket shelling during the war.
The Shaban's house is already cracked by poverty and also by the missiles of the two wars on Gaza, the 2008-2009 war and the late 2012 war. The Israeli rockets accurately hit targets other than the Shaban's house. They destroyed nearly 1,000 of a total of 4,000 industrial facilities. Many of the rest have completely stopped working due to the blocking imposed on the Gaza Strip since mid-2007.
This factory used to work in concrete in the Gaza Strip. It provided job opportunities to about 70 workers. During the pre-war period, we had 17 mixing vehicles and 7 concrete pumps. 10 of these vehicles were destroyed, and only 7 remained. In spite of this, I want to bring this factory to life again to make a living. I want to contribute to the reconstruction of Gaza, but now there are small quantities of goods entering Gaza. More than 3,900 factories have stopped either completely or partly as a result of the prevention of raw materials and production requirements from coming in. Moreover, the Israeli occupation bombed many industrial facilities during the last two wars on the Strip. Most of the destroyed institutions started having problems with any production process. This made more than 45,000 workers, only in the field of production and industry, lose their jobs, which has led to an increase in unemployment.
With the siege tightening and factories systematically destroyed by the Israeli occupation, Gazans are tempted to break the siege through digging underground tunnels along the border with Egypt to bring in their daily needs of food and medications, as well as raw materials that may contribute to operating some industrial facilities in one way or another.
Many industrial institutions and laborers were working when some of the materials were allowed in through the tunnels. This softened the effects of the siege on the Strip. These tunnels, or the ground crossings as we call them, provided job opportunities to 35,000 workers in the construction sector and other industrial sectors through the entry of raw materials. My basic profession is sewing. As you know, sewing is not common now. We used to have orders from the north of Palestine. The crossings are blocked now, and there are no exchanges with Israel. In general, the sewing profession has stopped now, and I came to Rafah. In Rafah, there were opportunities and tunnels. Our area of concentration was construction materials, and especially gravel. Lately, transporting gravel has become difficult, so we started transporting goods. Merchants started providing us with goods through the tunnels. We rebuilt the factory. It used to give jobs to 70 employees. Now we are running one factory with one operational capacity. There used to be 70 people, but now there are only 30.
Tunnels became a lifeline for the residents of the Gaza Strip. The economy began to recover and unemployment rates were significantly reduced, either because of work in the tunnels or the supply of goods, especially with thousands of tons of cement, steel and gravel arriving daily. All of that led to dozens of large enterprises, including the reconstruction of Gaza, after the Israeli destruction of thousands of houses and public facilities. But all of these improvements have stopped with the demolition of the tunnels. Gaza became besieged again, causing the unemployment rates to increase.
There is destruction in tunnels. Every day, a cement or steel tunnel is destroyed. The tunnel line requires at least 20 workers. It may be more, but there are not less than 20. The Egyptians said they have destroyed 350 tunnels. This is what has been destroyed. We don't know whether they have destroyed the rest or not. They have demolished 300 or 360 tunnels, each requiring 20 workers. This means that a total of about 6,000 workers are now unemployed. Relying on tunnels was not on the agenda of the Palestinians. This means bringing in food, clothes, and medication through the tunnels. But the phenomenon was forced on the Gazans, leaving them with no choice. Thus began the circle of providing jobs to the deprived in construction and production factories because of the Israeli restrictions. When Egyptian security takes an action in this regard, along with not allowing these materials to officially enter the strip, the problem of unemployment will become worse. I was doing well, and now I've got 30 workers. However, if tunnels remain blocked, I will reduce the number to half because there are no goods coming in. I recently divided the workers into two groups. Each works for 15 days. If the situation remains the same, I may lay off 15 workers, and I will cause the destruction of 15 families. I was working for a short period of time. Now I have stopped because there is no cement. I have 13 people in my house. Four of my sons are unemployed. They are all illiterate. No one else is employed. I have to take care of my daughters, my wife, and my daughters-in-law. The situation used to be different. There were job opportunities and life went on. We used to work and make a living for the family. Life was better. Nowadays, the situation is different because there are no goods or cement, the crossings are blocked, and there's a siege imposed. I don't use the work equipment I have, and I have to afford the living expenses of 13 people.
Everybody is unemployed. There is no chance for construction workers, laborers, and contractors. They're all unemployed. Where will they find jobs? Even employees are complaining about the hard situation. If you intend to borrow some money from an employee, he will tell that his salary is hardly enough for him and his children. For those who receive salaries at the end of the month, they keep telling that it's not enough. An employee's salary is $400. Is it enough? The doctor with a certificate does not find work, as well as the engineer. Are there any projects or hospitals that provide work chances? Let new factories open to help workers find a chance. Is there electricity for factory work? If there were factories and construction projects, no one would need anyone else. We wouldn't need anything from the Israeli occupation, and no one would starve, because when a worker gets a chance, sometimes it's going to be much better than an employee's.
There was a project for the development of the sea.
There was a project to develop the beach, thus expanding the street by the beach, but the work stopped. Look at this sidewalk. They are supposed to be paving another lane of the street. During the time I spent heading to the office or going home, I used to see many machines, engineers, and laborers working on the project. However, they aren't working anymore due to the lack of construction materials and fuel. This caused the company to stop the development of the street. In addition, many of the workers and engineers who used to work on the project stopped and became a part of the unemployed sector that already existed in the Gaza Strip.
The continuous closure of tunnels and the border crossings does not only exacerbate the high rates of unemployment, it also severely affects the performance of factories, the supply, the local market, with many essential products.
After stopping our work and having it ruined, you can see that we are hunting for work in making a wallet or repairing a bag, just like that. During the past 6 months, we noticed a slowdown in the sectors of clothes and sewing. That happened because of the lack of activation. You can add to this the productive and service sectors. They would be severely affected, and we would go back to the time, before 3 or 4 years ago, when there was great unemployment, a lack of goods and materials needed daily, and a growing crisis in many sectors that would unfortunately worsen the humanitarian and social problems in the Gaza Strip. I was affected anyway. I cannot even fulfill the requirements of my customers or serve their interest. I pack gravel, but I can't do the same with cement. However, there is no cement, and when it is available, I can work with other workers. You can see that nobody works. Cars do not work, or employees either. Some workers come here seeking a chance at work, but I tell them there are no construction materials. If you can bring me any materials in the local market, I am ready to give you a chance at work. I've got the money and the intention. I am also in a hurry. I need to move to my new house. Today we ordered the bricks. The factory said that the bricks are not ready because there is no cement. I have been asking a blacksmith to build me a stair rod. The blacksmith agrees to make me one, but says we should agree on something first. He asks for extra money. When I ask about the reason, he says because there is no steel.
Freezing of small or large projects, the obstruction of industrial facilities, and the increase of the unemployment rate to more than 40% are all considered disasters that threaten to affect a wide range of the population of the Gaza Strip.
I and my sister-in-law were in the kitchen. My son was standing here, and my sister-in-law's sons were there. I was preparing milk for my son, and he was catching my clothes crying. The boiling pan slipped from my hand and burnt it. I should have gone to the hospital, but I couldn't afford it. I didn't have $1 to go to the hospital. I had a bacterium in the blood, and the doctor told me that this infection was caused by a polluted environment. I told him about the condition of our house, and during winter, my house becomes full of water. He said that was the reason. I recently had some analysis and found that I have problems in my chest. The doctor said I need medical treatment, and the prescription contained only 2 pills that cost $30, and I can't afford buying one. How would I buy those pills? The doctor gave it to me for free once because he knows about my situation. He also treats my patient's son and follows his case. He paid for the medication that time, but how would I afford paying for the rest? How can I buy 2 pills for $30?
The Palestinians are steadfast and patient people. They have been suffering, but they are aware that the main reason is the Zionist occupation. The occupation has been trying to suppress the Palestinians, but we say that they are patient, steadfast, and will continue to be so. They will keep fighting the occupier with their steadfastness and an honorable attitude opposing these conspiracies. بصموده وبوقفته المشرفة ضد هذه المؤامرات.
The limelight.
For all the tolerance and enlightenment that modern society claims, Americans are losing hold of a fundamental right as citizens of a free country, the right to speak their minds and voice their opinions in public without fear of being shamed or shunned. The article you're about to hear has been published by the New York Times Opinion Section and has been written by the paper's editorial board. The piece is titled, America Has a Free Speech Problem. For all the tolerance and enlightenment that modern society claims, Americans are losing hold of a fundamental right as citizens of a free country, the right to speak their minds and voice their opinions in public without fear of being shamed or shunned. This social silencing, this depluralizing of America has been evident for years, but dealing with it stirs yet more fear. It feels like a third rail, dangerous. For a strong nation and open society, that is dangerous. How has this happened? In large part, it's because the political left and the political right are caught in a destructive loop of condemnation and recrimination around cancel culture. Many on the left refuse to acknowledge that cancel culture exists at all, believing that those who complain about it are offering cover for bigots to peddle hate speech. Many on the right, for all their braying about cancel culture, have embraced an even more extreme version of censoriousness as a bulwark against a rapidly changing society, with laws that would ban books, stifle teachers, and discourage open discussion in classrooms. Many Americans are understandably confused, then, about what they can say and where they can say it. People should be able to put forward viewpoints, ask questions and make mistakes, and take unpopular but good faith positions on issues that society is still working through, all without fearing cancellation. However you define cancel culture, Americans know it exists and feel its burden. In a new national poll commissioned by the New York Times Opinion and Siena College, only 34% of the Americans said they believed that all Americans enjoyed freedom of speech completely. The Opinion poll found that 84% of adults said it is a very serious or somewhat serious problem that some Americans do not speak freely in everyday situations because of fear of retaliation or harsh criticism. This poll and other recent surveys from the Pew Research Center and from the Knight Foundation reveal a crisis of confidence around one of America's most basic values. Freedom of speech and expression is vital to human beings' search for truth and knowledge about our world. A society that values freedom of speech can benefit from the full diversity of its people and their ideas. At the individual level, human beings cannot flourish without the confidence to take risks, pursue ideas, and express thoughts that others might reject. Most importantly, freedom of speech is the bedrock of democratic self-government. If people feel free to express their views in their communities, the democratic process can respond to and resolve competing ideas. Ideas that go unchallenged by opposing views risk become weak and brittle rather than being strengthened by tough scrutiny. When speech is stifled or when dissenters are shut out of public discourse, a society also loses its ability to resolve conflict, and it faces the risk of political violence. The New York Times Opinion, Siena College poll found that 46% of respondents said they felt less free to talk about politics compared to a decade ago. 30% said they felt the same. Only 21% of people reported feeling freer, even though in the past decade there was a vast expansion of voices in the public square through social media. There's a crisis around the freedom of speech now because many people don't understand it. They weren't taught what it means and why it matters, said Suzanne Nossel, the chief executive of PEN America, a free speech organization. Safeguards for free speech have been essential to almost all social progress in the country, from the civil rights movement to women's suffrage to the current fights over racial justice and the police. New York Times Opinion commissioned the poll to provide more data and insight that can inform a debate mired in extremes. This editorial board plans to identify a wide range of threats to freedom of speech in the coming months and to offer possible solutions. Freedom of speech requires not just a commitment to openness and tolerance in the abstract. It demands conscientiousness about both the power of speech and its potential harms. We believe it isn't enough for Americans to just believe in the rights of others to speak freely. They should also find ways to actively support and protect those rights. We are under no illusion that this is easy. Our era, especially, is not made for this. Social media is awash in speech of the point scoring, picking apart, piling on, put down variety. A deluge of misinformation and disinformation online has heightened this tension.